Well, good morning. This is Bruce Silverman, and today I have in the studio a Portland native who hasn't spent much time in Portland for almost 20 years now. Her name is Liza Gadsby, and she is one of the co-founders of an organization that is trying to save, protect, enhance the population and the life of a species you've probably never heard of. It's called the drill, and we'll explain what drills are and maybe some species that they're similar to. But first, welcome to KBOO, Liza.
Thank you, Bruce.
Liza, what is a drill?
Well, not to be confused with a mandrill. A drill is not a female mandrill. It's the other member of the genus Mandrillus. Most people are familiar from zoos here in the U.S. Here in Portland, we have mandrills at the Oregon Zoo. But drills are very rare in captivity. They're divided by a single river in the middle of Cameroon, the Sanaga, and to the south of that you have mandrills, and to the north of it you have drills. So obviously at some point in history they speciated across that river.
Okay, and these are primates. They're pretty high up the intelligence list, I would say. And for those who may have seen them in a zoo or in a book somewhere and can't remember, mandrills are these large ape-like things that have sort of a rubber mask, which has a black background and some bright red and some white and some blue, I think. And drills are very similar. They have also a black rubber mask, but don't have much of the color on that. Some color on the fur, but mostly black, is that right?
That's right. They have a beautiful sort of moon-shaped face, like a kabuki mask, which is jet black. The body coloration is similar to mandrills. The hair is a little bit more golden than the mandrill, but I like to think the drills are more beautiful. Of course, I'm biased, more elegant, while the mandrill's a little bit gaudy.
Okay. Even though this is radio, you will be able to look at pictures of these animals. At the end, we're going to give the website for Liza's organization, which is called Pandrillus. Let's talk about more about the animals before we get into the history of your project there in Africa. What kind of a social life do they engage in, and what do they eat, and do they migrate? Do they stay in one place all their lives? Tell us interesting stuff about that.
Like all primates, they're highly social. They live in large groups from 25 to 40, probably the basic group unit, in the rainforest of Central West Africa. Or West Central Africa, actually.
Well, let's name the two countries.
Actually, it's three. Nigeria, Cameroon, and Equatorial Guinea, but not the mainland Equatorial Guinea. Part of that country is on an island called Bioko, which is off the shore of Cameroon. And it's just a little corner of Nigeria, a little corner of Cameroon, and this island of Bioko.
Okay, and this is not too far from the equator. We're talking about tropical forest, mostly forested land, or originally forested anyway.
Yes, it was originally all forest.
What do drills eat in the wild?
They, some colleagues of mine in Cameroon have been analyzing feces from wild drills, so we do have some scientific data on this. Primarily their diet is fruit, but they also eat mushrooms, they eat quite a few insects. They love to dig, they're great excavators, and they dig up roots and shoots and little tubers. They are real omnivores, but primarily fruit is the largest component of their diet.
Do they spend most time up in the trees or most on the ground or what?
They spend most of their day on the ground and they go up just before nightfall and sleep in the trees and come down after dawn. So they're absolutely immobile at night in the treetops, and by day they're on the ground. And drills and mandrills are different than most primates that have a home range, so to speak, that they defend very actively in the case of chimpanzees, or that they move around in opportunistically depending on food supplies, like in the case of baboons in the savanna. Drills and mandrills, nobody really can quite get a handle on their ecology, certainly not drills. There's been more research on mandrills down in places like Gabon. But they're semi-nomadic throughout the year, and they travel over fairly large distances. It is believed, following perhaps fruiting trees, water sources. We have a very long, intense dry season in our part of the African rainforest, which is unusual. And also, I think the reason they're nomadic may also, and this is supposition, have something to do with their reproductive life. And unlike other species of primate, nobody emigrates from a drill group. Young females, for example, emigrate from gorilla groups. Young males emigrate from baboon groups. In chimpanzees, it's all kind of up in the air. But with drills, everybody stays in the group that they were born in. But once a year, usually in the middle of rainy season, and we know this from the hunters, the drill groups in any given area come together in what the local hunters call a jam, or what we scientists call a supergroup. And they stay together for days or maybe a week, and we think that's the time that individuals transfer between groups, therefore avoiding inbreeding in the wild. That's their mechanism. So when you have a situation where what we have in the wild today with few groups scattered over a large area, these supergroups are probably not occurring. And this is what hunters were telling us 20 years ago, that they don't see the supergroups anymore. So that has very dire genetic implications for remaining drills in the wild. So it is important that we get some genetic material back into the wild.
What's the problem with the population? You got to Africa. I should explain. You were in Portland, and you were just traveling in Africa, and wound up learning that here was a species that hadn't been studied by Western scientists, or
that's correct.
Yeah. And when was this that you got
this
there?
Was 1988.
20 years ago.
We came into Nigeria. We were driving from London, and our ultimate destination was Botswana, sort of a year or two personal safari, and we never made it to Botswana. We came into Nigeria on a 10-day transit visa and stayed for 20 years.
Okay. You're saying we. Let's mention your colleague in this, another Portlander.
Yes, Peter Jenkins.
And co-founder of the Pandrillus
yep.
organization. So you knew that these animals, their habitat was disappearing, they weren't being treated well. In much of Africa, anything that moves is shot and eaten, and you got concerned. But you can't put out the call for help for a species unless you really know just how bad it has become, right?
Yeah, and actually, we got engaged originally with a Nigerian conservation group who we just met, as you just meet people when you're traveling, and they had just discovered that gorillas lived in a little corner of southeast Nigeria, and they thought we looked like hapless fools and had some requisite skills, and asked us if we wanted to spend 6 months working with communities in a particular area to try to learn more about these gorillas and set up a community conservation program. And we thought that sounded like a good opportunity. And so we said, sure. And we did that for a year. During that time, we learned about drills and learned that drills had also recently been rediscovered there. Of course, the local people knew, but the international scientific community didn't know. So we became far more interested in drills than gorillas, because as a species, gorillas are far less endangered. We know quite a bit about them, even if we didn't know much about this particular population in Nigeria. And we also learned that drills were very endangered in zoos, that they hardly existed. And then, of course, we became the proud owners of an infant orphan drill, and we decided to redirect our energies on drills rather than gorillas.
How did that happen?
During the time we had been living in the bush, working with these communities and searching for gorillas, we, you know, you have your mammal book and you look at all the pictures of the things that you'd like to see, and the coolest looking thing in the whole book was the drill, and we're like, wow, drills live here, but we never saw one. And then one day we were in town in a bar, and ironically called the Monkey Bar, and had a reputation for keeping monkeys, and there was a little drill only a few weeks old in a shoebox, and that was the first drill that I'd ever seen.
Why did it become yours, though?
It was on death's door, actually. It was comatose and dehydrated, and you know, it would still obviously be relying solely on its mother nursing for food at that age, and had been, its finger had been bitten off by a rat and was infected, and the skin was peeling back from the bone, and it was very pathetic.
So did you ask for it?
We'll take care of it.
And the owner of the bar said okay? Or
the owner said, no, you can't do that. You have to buy it. And we said, well, we can't do that either. So why don't you let us take care of it until it's better, and then we'll talk about it some more. And I'm proud to report that 20 years later, she's still with us, and she's the mother of 8 and grandmother of 9 and great-grandmother of 1.
Wow. Okay, so you had this close encounter with a new species and started your research and your work. How did you find out how many drills there are in the forest and how many there used to be to determine how rapidly the population is decreasing?
Well, I'm not sure we ever did figure that out, but we tried, and we spent about 3 years looking for drills, and we took what little literature there was and created a proposal that we would go into every area where drills may have lived before, might have lived before, might still occur on the mainland, so not including Bioko, so southeast Nigeria and part of southwest Cameroon. And we had, you know, our vehicle. We were all prepared to travel overland, and we were already in the field and equipped, so it didn't cost us very much money to do this. And it didn't seem like, because there are so few drills, everybody thought, including us, that it didn't seem like we can just trek around the forest and hope to run into some and count them. That would not have been productive. So we designed it as a hunter interview survey. And to do that, you set up a quite formal protocol of how you're going to extract information from knowledgeable but uneducated, mostly illiterate people without them knowing really what information you're after. And we spent several years and interviewed almost 500 individual hunters in southeast Nigeria and southwest Cameroon to pick their brains about drills.
And first you have to go to the village chief and get permission and find out who is the hunter with the knowledge of history.
That's right.
I saw your questionnaire. It was very detailed. Give me an example of just how specific you had to be to get information from folks on how often they encountered drills now and in the past.
Well, the main thing was to engage them in a discussion. And, you know, you can't pay them. You can have a case of beer, which you all enjoy during the interview. You don't want them to know what you're really after. That's the main thing, because they'll just tell you what they think you want to hear. Mm-hmm. And so we started out asking them questions about themselves and how much they hunt and hunting practices and their methodology. And we would do group interviews and try to get a mixture of younger active hunters and older, very experienced hunters, because they could tell us what the situation was like 40 or 50 years earlier. And we were obviously interested in the historical progression of the species population. And, you know, the reliability factor is quite variable. So you need to determine who's good, and you ask a lot of trick questions, and you ask them to tell you every kind of monkey they know and the names in their local language and what they look like. And you never ask leading questions. You don't say, does it have an orange nose? Because they'll say yes. Mm-hmm. You say, what color of nose does it have? So there's all kinds of elaborate tricks you use. And then eventually you figure out which of the guys really know what they're talking about. And after a few hours, then you start asking specific questions about drills. But after you've done this for a few months, and we'd already lived there for a year, and worked with hunters in the bush, you know the answers to the questions, largely. And so you very quickly can determine who knows what he's talking about and who's just a stand-in for somebody else who's out of town.
So you did all that work, all those interviews. Are you able to put some kind of number on how many drills there are still in the world?
No. My gut feeling is there are between 3,000 and 5,000, and probably on the low end. And that's not very many. We hear a lot about gorillas, for example, as an endangered primate. There are probably 60 to 80,000 gorillas left in the wild. And some recent work has indicated that there may be half again as many more than that. Chimpanzees, the other species that we work with, populations estimates are between 180 and 250,000 chimpanzees remaining in the wild. And that's not a lot of chimps, mm-hmm. but it is a lot when you compare that to 3,000 to 5,000 drills. So that's okay. About as precise as I'm willing to get.
Okay, and any idea what proportion that is compared to, say, 100 years ago or before recent development and destruction of the land?
Well, I would imagine they are probably living at about 20% in existing remaining habitat of the carrying capacity for that habitat. Then, so if you put a multiplier of 5 on that figure, then they have probably lost over half of the habitat that was available to them 100 years ago. So put another multiplier of 2 on top of that. So at one time, there were probably up to 100,000 drills.
And now there are 3,000 to 5,000 probably.
Yeah.
You mentioned habitat destruction. Let's talk a little bit more about that and the other threats. What's been happening here?
Well, you have to realize that there probably never were very many drills to begin with. And that's a very important thing to know, because their whole world range, if you drew a line on the map around it, not taking into account how much habitat has been lost within that area, it's only about 40,000 square kilometers. So that translates to an area smaller than West Virginia, or to bring it home here to Oregon, the area in Oregon west of I-5.
Okay.
That's not a very big area, yeah? Is bigger than the whole world range that was ever available to drills. So there never were very many to begin with. It's the smallest known range of any African primate, and we're talking about 62 species of primate in Africa.
So what's been happening to that range?
Well, within that area, of course, southeast Nigeria is one of the most heavily populated parts of the continent, southwest Cameroon a bit less so, but you're still looking at a fairly high human population density. So you have habitat is just gone, and it's cut up by roads, so it gets isolated into habitat islands. Then that shrinks around the edges. Around every village is, a giant swath, a ripple effect of farmland and areas, even where you have existing habitat then, have been hunted out. So when we were doing our survey work now almost 20 years ago, it was apparent that drills had been isolated into at least 12 separate habitat islands, which means they're not going to leave that area. So you're looking at a conglomerate of little subpopulations, and some of those are too small to be viable population-wise in the long term.
Any development, any growth of civilization spreading out of cities is extreme in Nigeria, because the population, just in your 20 years, can you tell me what it was when you got there and what it is now?
It's doubled.
Doubled in 20 years.
Who knows, but the estimate now for Nigeria is 150 million people.
Wow.
So you're looking at a population that is a little, maybe 40% of the U.S.'s population in an area the size of Texas and Oklahoma.
I want to talk about two other causes of habitat destruction. One is logging, and one is burning to create farm fields out of woods.
That's right. And logging is usually the first ingress into the forest. They go in, they take out the choice trees, and then this opens up the area, A, to farmers, because the heavy clearing is done, and they go in and burn the rest and plant their crops, and B, the biggest problem, and this applies not so much in southeast Nigeria, which is more developed, but in Cameroon and right across the Congo Basin of Africa, is access. And where you have logging, they got to put in roads and bridges to go in there and get their trees out. Right? So you've got access. Once you've got access, hunters go in there and set up camps. And this is what happens in Cameroon and the rest of Central Africa, where you've got camps of non-indigenous people. I mean, they're indigenous to that country, but they are not local people. They're not from the local ethnic group or tribe. So they really don't have any traditional hunting rights there, and they're hunting entirely commercially. They go in and set up their camps, and then little vehicles come in on the nice roads that the loggers left behind and pick up the bushmeat and take it to the urban markets on a regular basis.
Bushmeat. Tell us about bushmeat and how the desire for bushmeat has affected the drills.
It's affected the drills, and it's affecting every animal in Central and West Africa. And that is the thing. You have situations where you have national parks that are empty of animals. We have situations where habitat is protected or even just left alone, unprotected, and there's nothing there bigger than a squirrel. And it's all because of bushmeat hunting. And the thing that you need to understand about it is it's not subsistence hunting, by and large. In most areas, it's for an urban market. And the people who are consuming bushmeat could be consuming chicken, goat, sheep, beef, fish, whatever. A local hunter now, the guys who are actually killing these endangered species, will laugh and say, I don't eat this stuff. Bushmeat is for the rich. And the terrible irony of it is that the poor hunter's children are still suffering from protein deficiency. He's not feeding this meat to his kids. Some guy in an urban area who's driving a Mercedes, who could be eating anything he wants, is the only person that can afford bushmeat.
Bushmeat is now for the rich. Wow.
You betcha.
That's news. Clearly, if the species is going to be saved, There has to be some change in attitudes among various types and groups of people, and also some purposeful preservation of some habitat, right?
Yep.
You have created two facilities where you are housing and breeding and taking care of some drills. One in Cameroon, one in Nigeria, right?
That's correct.
Tell us about them.
Well, the project in Nigeria is the original project, our flagship project, so to speak. And it was established to take in orphan drills because in the very beginning, this started when we were still doing our field work. We rented a house so that we could put some volunteers and some staff and some orphan drills there, and we carried on with our field work. We did this because while we were learning that the drill really was in a dire situation in the wild, we also had been in contact with zoos in Europe and the United States and learned that drills were also in a very dire situation in zoos. There was no backup viable captive population in the world. So if they were indeed, as we suspected, hurtling towards extinction in the wild, there wasn't any reservoir of drills. And at the same time, we would see little orphan drills like the one in the shoebox in the bar and others in villages, and some not little, some adults that had managed to survive somehow chained up to a post in a village, and they're adults. And we thought, what a waste. What a waste from a captive breeding and population standpoint. What a waste for these individual animals, and they're suffering a great deal from an animal welfare point of view. It was terrible. And what a waste from a conservation education resource opportunity point of view. If we could get these animals and put them together, okay, they haven't had much luck breeding drills in zoos, maybe we can do it. Don't ask me what made me think we could, but we said, let's give it a try. Maybe we can do it here. And so we begin gathering these animals up. Obviously, we never bought them because that would only encourage people to go get more orphans, and we can't support the trade in wildlife. Plus, it's illegal to buy them. The laws are excellent on the books in Nigeria and Cameroon. They're just not very well enforced. Mm-hmm. And so to fast forward a bit, we've taken in 79 orphan wild-born drills over the years in Nigeria, and we have bred about 240 successfully, 100% mother-rearing success with our hand-reared wild-born females, which is what the zoos told us you're never going to be able to do. If you hand-rear these females, they're not going to be able to rear their own offspring. Rubbish. They're perfect. They're great. And this has become the world's most successful captive breeding program for an endangered primate. And we did it, you know, a couple of yahoos from Portland, Oregon, with very few resources. And it was all on-the-job training in our backyard in Nigeria.
Okay, and you call this place Drill Ranch.
Yes. Well, the official name is the Drill Rehabilitation and Breeding Center, but that's kind of devolved into Drill Ranch. And then the other project in Cameroon really started more as a general orphan animal rescue center, particularly for chimpanzees. Cameroon is probably the most important country remaining for chimpanzees. It has two subspecies of chimp. It has quite a bit of forest left. Logging is a massive industry there, and hunting is a massive industry there. And doing our field work there, I think in 18 months in the field, we had a database of 45 chimps that we saw tied up on the side of the road, being kept in bars and cities and whatnot, and it wasn't a good thing. So we got the government to agree that we would partner with them and take an abandoned, semi-abandoned government zoo that had a lot going for it in terms of location and infrastructure, and the government was very willing to cooperate. We'd work together and make this a facility primarily for chimpanzees. And we have over 50 chimps there now. We also have over a dozen gorillas, and we have another drill group there, one very large breeding group of about, medium-large breeding group of about 60.
So how many drills do you have in your care at this time, roughly?
Roughly? 300 in Nigeria and about 55 in Cameroon.
And the goal is to let them loose, so to speak.
Well, the first goal was to create a viable captive population.
Mm-hmm.
Check, we've done that. The second goal was to use these animals as ambassadors for their species where it matters most, in the countries where they are endemic, and the opportunity to expose the public of those nations to their own wildlife and to get them interested, because only when people are interested in their wildlife are they going to make any sort of cultural shift to preserve those animals. So our program in Nigeria is open to the public, free of charge, 9 to 5, 365 days a year. Our program in Cameroon also open those hours. There's a small fee for nationals, a large fee for non-nationals. Mm. It's a government facility. They want to charge something. People are happy to pay it. And we can always waive that fee for school groups and whatnot. And I think we've also really succeeded in putting drills on the map, both in the countries where they live, just through PR, just by talking to people, being available. The media in Nigeria is incredibly supportive. It's got the freest press in Africa. It always has, right through the military dictatorship time. Nigerian journalists are really tops, and they've been great to us, and it's helped a lot.
And so attitudes have changed through your work.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't want to appear immodest, but I could definitely say that we have made a change. Everybody in Nigeria knows what a drill is. The president came and visited our project. President, during his 8 years, President Obasanjo never even went to one of his national parks, but he came and visited our project, and it was such a great boost to conservation because everybody saw, wow, these animals are important, and the forest is important. The president, it's the first time he's ever come to our tribal area in the history of Nigeria, and he came to see the forest and to see the drills and chimps, and he had a good time.
Okay, land has been set aside, right?
Yep.
Tell us about the sanctuary.
Well, there's the sanctuary, but I should scroll back. Why did we work very, very hard at great personal cost for many years to get a wildlife sanctuary created? And by that, I don't mean a sanctuary, a captive facility. I mean, as we call a wildlife sanctuary in this country, land set aside. It was because in our first few years there, we had been very involved in creating a large national park of drill habitat. And there was one important area that was left out of the park for drills and chimpanzees and gorillas. And so that was where we decided to locate Drill Ranch and work with the local communities to try to get this area, which at the time was a production forest reserve, made into a wildlife sanctuary. And we succeeded, and I'm glad we did, because the national park, we had such high hopes for it 20 years ago. Well, 18 years ago when it started, and there was so much international conservation aid and support and expertise, so-called expertise, poured into it, and it hasn't worked at all. It's just a free hunting zone. It is, other than the habitat being somewhat protected, there's hardly any animals left there. The wildlife sanctuary that we've created, the Afi Mountain Wildlife Sanctuary, we got the government to upgrade its protected status from forest reserve to wildlife sanctuary. We pulled in three other NGOs. One Nigerian, another American NGO, and a British NGO, and we've worked as a partnership with the state government to really get some protection on the ground there. Before that happened in 2000, the legal creation of the sanctuary, we worked with the communities there for 7 years doing a community protection program, which worked. We kind of hired the best hunter from each village and gave him a uniform and a salary and said, go stop hunters. And it worked. It was amazing. It really worked. And we didn't really have any legal authority, and neither did these guys. So we did it on the basis of traditional authority. Even though this was government reserve, the communities have, and this was part of the genius in some ways of the way British colonial law created these reserves back in the 30s, was that the communities who had traditionally gathered and hunted on those lands had rights within government reserves. So we used that and said, this is your land to some extent, and used that authority. So the hunters were taken back to their home village, and the community council or whoever, whatever the community decided to do, they could impose whatever fine or punishment they wanted on the hunter, and that gave them an incentive. It might be a crate of beer, it might be 5 crates of beer and a goat or something. And so there was incentive in the community to enforce this law. There was incentive for our unofficial rangers to enforce it. And it all kind of worked. Meanwhile, we're doing a PR campaign with the villages and the big three, which are gorillas, drills, and chimpanzees.
I'm talking with Liza Gadsby, a Portlander who is co-founder of an organization called Pandrillus, centered in Nigeria and Cameroon, which is doing its best for a primate called the drill. Liza, Afi Mountain Wildlife Sanctuary, the land has been set aside now for some years. You feel apparently pretty confident that if drills, your currently captive drills, are released there, that they'll be pretty safe. Is that going to happen?
It's going to happen. And I do feel they'd be safe. It is definitely, and I can say this without reservation, the best protected piece of forest for drills in the world. There are national parks in both Nigeria and Cameroon, in drill habitat, substantial areas of land, but there's no meaningful protection from hunting. And we do have that at Afi. And so we are now processing our largest drill group, which is almost 100 animals, for release. 100 animals in four generations. There's only six of original wild-born orphan animals left in that group. These are their offspring and grand and great-grand offspring. So most of the animals have been born in a sort of Jurassic Park-style large enclosure in the rainforest. It's about 7 hectares with a big electric fence run off our solar power system. And they've never been handled by people up till now. We are processing each individual animal for their final medical screening. We're implanting a microchip. We're taking blood samples that will go in permanent storage. And I think in a couple of months, the animals are going to be ready to go. We still have to do some community work, talking to everyone in the 17 villages around the mountain about the release and what they should do if they see one of these animals, what they should do and what we will do if these animals come out of the forest and onto their farms and start making havoc, which I don't think they will do, but it is a possibility we need to be prepared for. One of the biggest challenges left for us is figuring out the telemetry system. How are we going to track these animals?
You feel pretty confident that the animals will be okay in the wild, that they won't go into town to find food from people's hands?
I do. And I could be completely wrong, but I really feel quite confident. And I'm saying this based on the behavior of the animals themselves, the fact that they have, most of the animals in the group have lived in the forest, in the enclosure, but they've lived there their whole life. And also, we've had some experimental unplanned releases, aka escapes. And those have been very instructive. None of those animals have ever gone to people's farms. They have all kind of, they have gone and shopped around the other groups. We have 5 groups in separate enclosures up at Afi. It's usually adolescent males. It makes perfect sense, or low-ranking females, and they're looking for a better social situation for themselves. They shop around the group. Either we recapture them and put them back, or we let them select a new group if that works out for them. We try to put as much animal management in the hands of the animals themselves. I mean that with all seriousness. Or occasionally they just disappear, and those animals who've disappeared have never been seen again, which I take as a good sign. I am relying so much on our local communities for this release. It only takes one miscreant to ruin the whole thing. Yeah, one guy could go out and shoot the whole group in a day if he had enough cartridges. They could do it. And one guy would do it, yeah. But our program is the largest private employer in this tribal area. And by and large, people know its value.
You employ local people mostly.
We expatriates are all volunteers, including me, after 20 years. I've never been successful enough at fundraising to pay myself or Peter a salary, which is pathetic. And anyone listening out there who would like to support us, we would be very grateful. But yes.
Okay, and we'll give the website at the end.
All of our staff are local, of course. Not all are from the Boki tribe where we are. We do have some people from elsewhere in Nigeria. Our manager is a Yoruba from the West, for example. And we try to actually maximize ethnic diversity on our project for a variety of reasons. But I am relying on the local people. You know, if we release this group and some of them are shot, it's still worth it. If any of these animals survive to reproduce in the wild, to meet the few wild drills which are struggling to survive out there, and form new groups with them and breed with them, we've achieved our goal. Even if only 10 of them survive, we've achieved our goal. And I know that if the animals had the opportunity to answer the question, would you rather stay in this nice enclosure where you're fed and life is easy, or go try and make it in the wild, I know that they would want to go back to the wild. So I'm willing to risk it. But we do rely on cooperation of the local people. Government is extremely important, and this is part of the reason that I'm not a big believer about community-based conservation. You know, I've done it. That's what we did when we did the community ranger program, and it did work, but it's not sustainable. Government has to be in there. Just like we could not run Yellowstone with people from the local communities. I mean, who would ever propose such a thing in this country? And yet this is what conservationists and aid workers propose when they go to developing countries, that people in these communities are going to be in charge of protected areas and natural resource management. You got to be kidding me. They need to be involved, yes, but government has to play their lead role. You've got to have government's commitment. At the end of the day, protection is a law enforcement activity, and it isn't any different over there in that regard than it is here.
We can see drills in two ways. One is to visit you in Africa, and the other is to go to your website. Let's mention that actually the website, which we'll give in a moment, you can see pictures of drills and learn a little bit about them. And you can also learn how to become a volunteer there in Nigeria, and also how to donate. Okay, what is the website?
www.pandrillus, P-A-N-D-R-I-L-L-U-S, so pan, frying pan, drill, tool, and us, .org.
Pandrillus.org, and the word pandrillus is from the Latin name for this species.
That's right. The genus for drills and mandrills is mandrillus, and pan, of course, the Latin word for all.
Is there any other point that we should be discussing? Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I know that a lot of people here want to help. They don't have time to do anything more. They may never visit Africa. They don't even have time to look at websites. What I would urge you to do is, if you want to help wildlife or whatever it is, building schools, saving children, do a little bit of research and find small organizations, nonprofits, NGOs, what have you, who are doing focused projects, people who have a long-term track record at what they're doing in a particular area. And those things, I think, are most effective and most financially efficient in terms of getting things done.
Okay, and we should mention that Pandrillus Foundation is a 501c3 foundation with an address right here in Portland, Oregon. And if you want to find more information or donate, there is some reliability in that regulation by the government. Liza Gadsby, co-founder of Pandrillus. The website again is www.pandrillus.org. Liza, thank you very much for joining us on KBOO.
Thanks for having me.